Welcome to The Inner Game. I'm Gwen Garcelon, your host. Thanks for listening. The inner game is the relationship we have to our authentic purpose and contribution in life. It's about the ways that we grow personally and spiritually on the inside that affects everything on the outside of our lives. The quality of our inner game exerts a creative impact because our quantum world shifts to reflect our thoughts and feelings. Each of our contributions shapes the quality of what is possible for us all on the planet. These are conversations with people who are up to something evolutionary in their lives and an opportunity to hear about how these people take on their spiritual and personal growth and how that strengthens their organizations and offerings to make a bigger difference. Today's guest is Robert Egger, award-winning social entrepreneur and food system thought leader. He's a humanitarian, speaker, pioneer, and advocate for the creativity and power of the nonprofit sector. And one of my favorite anecdotes, he once made the Oprah magazine shortlist of the real sexiest men alive. Thanks for being with us, Robert.
It is a pleasure, my golden friend, Gwen.
Well, you know, it probably makes sense for you to start off with a little bit of a thumbnail story of the DC Central Kitchen, which was one of the miraculous things that you founded.
Happily, yeah. You know, I was a happy nightclub, entrepreneur who was dreaming of changing the world with music when I went out one night to feed men and women who were homeless on the streets of Washington in the mid-1980s. And asked, you know, two simple questions. Where's the food come from? Why on earth are we just serving people outside every day when we should be helping people off the streets? So I proposed a model that became the DC Kitchen and birthed, you know, hundreds of community kitchens around the world. Restaurants, hotels, hospitals throw away tons of food. Why don't we collect it, bring it to a central hub, and we can start a cooking school? Sadly, we're often viewed as part of the problem. They could become part of the solution by processing that food into balanced meals while they learned a skill that would allow them to get a job and support the very same restaurant industry that donated the food. So it was one of those everybody would win ideas that, I had originally proposed. I was hoping that some of the charities I went to would kind of take my idea and run with it, but I found that they were sadly, you know, kind of wed to an older system that, again, just, you know, redistributed food or fed the. And I was into kind of a liberation theology, you know, of like, it's not enough to feed somebody. So anyway, in 1988, I launched the DC Kitchen, which has produced, I think, about this stage and helped, you know, well over 2,500 people get employment and become self-sustaining.
Yeah, it's an amazing model that that incorporates so many of the things that I feel like every municipality needs. You know, to think about what they're doing with their food waste, how are they feeding those in need more? How are they training people for jobs that, you know, that they desperately need? And, you know, there's these things that are and supporting local farmers, which is something that, you know, increasingly the DC Central Kitchen and in turn the LA Kitchen were focused on. And I want to kind of pick up on those things and talk a little bit about how the lessons from the DC Central Kitchen can inform what every town is looking for right now in terms of, you know, food system resiliency.
Well, you know, you hit on one of my favorite subjects, which is every town. And I was intrigued. I started the kitchen. There was a lot of talk back then and in the 90s as kind of corporate philanthropy kicked in and everybody talked about business solutions. And there was this intense interest in ideas that could be replicated. And so I really focused, and again, counter to what many groups were saying, I only want to use things that exist in every town and that are pretty much free. So I said, look, the model is I'm going to take food that was thrown away, a kitchen that was underutilized, men and women on the streets or out of prison or out of drug treatment programs who are undervalued, volunteers who were desperately anxious to make an impact, chefs who had food but also could help teach, who had jobs. You know, all of those things were there. So not only did the initial idea of the DC kitchen flourish, because again, anybody could do it, but I started looking harder and harder and deeper into communities to see what else existed. And that's really where I started to kind of get focused on this idea of, you know, food contracts. And every city in America contracts for a wide variety of food things, whether it's school food, senior meat, summer food, even to the point where there's print foods and military food. So yeah, I started to look, again, existing resources, what's there. And I kept thinking, wow, wouldn't it be interesting if as a charity we could not only run a charitable site that would train people, but if some of the men and women were trained, and particularly old people struggling to find a job, why don't we create jobs? You know, our motivation isn't, profit for external shareholders. Our model is reinvested profit over and over. So not only could we support local farmers and create jobs, but we were a dream come true for the average mayor who were becoming more and more focused on the idea of keep money local, keep profits circulating in the economy as long as possible. And that opened the door to one of the first big contracts that DC Kitchen got, which was to produce locally sourced scratch cookbooks for DC public schools. Again, creating jobs for men and women who oftentimes said, I spent my youth messing this town up, and I feel like I'm getting a chance to help put it back together. But not only the meals healthy for the kind of a resurrection factor for the employees who were not only getting paid a good wage with benefits, but I think they felt like, man, I'm contributing, I'm doing something. My life and my work have meaning. That's what most people dream of.
It's such a beautiful way to look at how to put together resources more creatively. And I feel like that, exists.
You said it.
Small towns.
Why look any other way?
Right.
Why not? I mean, to your point, I only want to find beautiful ways to serve the community.
Right. So what could a small town like Carbondale do, to kind of build on these lessons and create greater food security and efficiency?
Well, I'll walk you through an interesting kind of set of examples of how we in other places were able to kind of get into this business, but also some of the barriers that I think are the next step. So first and foremost, I was the chair of the Mayor's Commission on Nutrition. These kind of early models led to commonly known as food security councils. And that's something I urge every city to have. Now, first and foremost, there really shouldn't be an election anywhere where candidates, particularly mayors, don't have the local food system and how they would partner businesses, again, make sure that they're supporting the local economy first and foremost. So can help people get. I ended up going to Los Angeles because the Food Policy Council there had proposed and was passed unanimously by the city council idea, which was called the Good Food Purchasing Act. And that, in effect, suggested that local agencies, city agencies that spent more than $10,000 a year needed to make an effort to check a wide variety of boxes with the food sourced locally. Were there, competitive wages paid or benefits? Were they cognizant of water use? So there was a wide variety of metrics that, again, supposedly were going to become a kind of a roadmap for city agencies to transition from their traditional source of food contracts, which was big corporate food companies, to local companies. Now, as I mentioned, this was pretty much voluntary. Believer now that these should be mandated guidelines, because again, what I found is the grasp of corporate food is very, very tight, and particularly in small towns where their, for example, their school food budget would be really tight. one of the things that I found and I really push back on now is that many of the food contractors offer rebates, which they do business by aggregating lots and lots of small contracts or big contracts. But their interest isn't really in the individual contract, even though they work hard to produce as best the meals as their system allows. Their interest is aggregate buying power. So they, in turn, can go to General Mills and other people and make profit based on large purchasing agreements. Now, many school systems started to ask for a cut of that money, and that has been used, this kind of under-the-table pay, has really poisoned the water. Schools and other kind of city contracts are also based, sadly, on low bid. You know, who is going to offer the cheapest price per meal? So this idea of cheap meals plus rebates is probably the next big leap that we who are interested in not only local food systems, but the policies that will get us there. So not only am I promoting now the idea of mandated Good Food Purchasing Act requirements, but also transitioning from low bid as the kind of benchmark to what I refer to as best value. And again, this is the idea of saying, look, low bid sounds good. And I can understand why most people think, you know, this is the best use of city money. But what you find is low bid is where you get a processed food. And, you know, you and I have talked before that what you have now is a society, particularly an aging society, in which chronic health-related illnesses is going to really put a strain on local health systems in cities big and small. Whether it's kids, juvenile diabetes, obesity, what we're seeing now is that cheap is costing local governments a lot.
Right.
Second, low bid at times where you get bad wages and the need for charity to help struggling workers make it through the month with food or child care. And then finally, you get exported profit, and that means any of those tax dollars leave town and never come back. So, you know, trying to say, let's do everything we can to keep the money local is, I think, the next big leap. And that involves, again, prioritizing the kind of behaviors, local purchasing, good wages, reinvested profit, healthier meals, or the inclusion of kids or seniors in the meal plan development itself. So those are the things that I think are the next steps that are quite attainable. All you really need is a strong mayor, city council, and advocates who really want to push the boundaries and get local food into the system.
It's such a need. Well, let me just take a quick break and say this is Gwen Garcelon, and you're listening to The Inner Game on KDNK. My guest today is Robert Egger, and we're talking about the role of local food systems and community resiliency in the face of growing climate and social impacts. And I do apologize for the sound quality. Robert is in rural New Mexico, and we're just hoping for the best connection here. So wanted to ask you, Robert, you know, in the face of the many crises that we face as challenges are developing on the planet, you know, somehow in our culture, it's, you know, we've developed a lot of shame and guilt around the experience of grief. And what I've found is that the more we share it, the more we process it and can find our own resiliency and courage in the face of it. And I just, you know, I just wonder what your experience of, you know, grief is these days and your own processing of it.
Well, you know, Gwen, thank you for asking. That's a great question. And, you know, I'm a white dude in America, so I try to be careful that I don't sound whiny when, frankly, so many doors have opened and so many of the opportunities I've had were based on that. So I don't want to be like, you know, woe is me. But, dude, it's like anybody, you know, there's pitfalls and things that throw you for a loop. And, you know, one of the biggest, you know, things that really I still grieve for is the L.A. Kitchen, which I opened and put everything into, that really wanted to pioneer was a healthy meal for a senior. And you know, how do we keep seniors engaged and active and needed as long as possible? Kind of shut down by the same pitfalls I just mentioned. Debates, or just frankly, sometimes lethargy. And I had to close. And that still causes me great grief because I had hoped to spend my 60s really pioneering, you know, this idea of inclusion and dynamism around senior meals. So, you know, that's something that, I've had a very successful career. And to suddenly have a nonprofit with such promise have to close its doors at the very moment when you're seeing such a wild escalation of need amongst our elders.
Right.
So, you know, I'm still kind of grappling with that.
Yeah. What helps you? What are some practices that you have in your life that you've developed over the years that you feel like help you just, you know, keep your own reserves up and keep serving the way that you do?
Well, you know, for the longest time, when I was a runner, and I wasn't a, you know, I'm not a fast runner, but it's just the zen of the run or the walk. Now, again, I'll be honest with you. You know, I was forgetting my enemies on the way out and then oftentimes plotting their death on the way back. So I'm no saint here, but it was a way I could process. And I still love taking long walks. But, you know, there's another thing I did that started out organically, just walking one day and found on the sidewalk a little heart scratched in cement. And I took a picture of it and I sent it home to my wife and said, you know, love on the road. And the next day I found another, and the next day I found another. And over the course of more than 15 years, I've amassed quite a staggering number of little hearts that has become my way of being present. You know, when I take walks, particularly if I'm visiting other cities, it's one thing to just kind of walk, but it's another thing to be present and really focused. So this love on the road has become a glorious little safari that reminds me every day that there's love all around you. And it's not just the superficial heart in cement, but it's the example we set for each other. It's the small acts of kindness that you can do yourself or you witness in the community that makes you realize, you know, things aren't as bad as they may seem. You know, deep down, humans are pretty decent people. They might be fearful at times of new ideas and change, but deep down, people are good. And that really constantly gives me faith.
Mm. There, I'm reading a book right now, and you know, it's talking a lot about being of benefit to something bigger than yourself, which is, of course, I think, you know, so many of us in the nonprofit world and in whatever sector you happen to be in have that as an ethic. And how has that, do you feel like, served you in, you know, continuing to just be full and whole in your life?
Well, you know what, Gwen? It's funny because I've worked with food service and, you know, hunger for most of my adult life now. But I became very aware of and very fixated on the what I lovingly call the deeper hunger. And that's this hunger we all have to be needed, to feel like, and from the richest person down to, you know, the person just walking out of prison after 35 years, people just want to feel needed and feel like they mattered. And once you get your head around that and you realize that rather than try and fix the problem, which is really beyond the means of 99.9% of us in the nonprofit world, if we can help everyday people see the role they can play, that they have strength, they have a gift, they have something to offer, everybody does, to me, that's the great missing opportunity of so many in the sector, that we should realize that what we have at our fingertips is a community full of people who are all but saying, use me, help me be of value, I want to contribute, you know, help me find that role. And if we realize that potential, I think a lot of the problems we try and fix with charity could be overcome very much, a whole lot quicker with community.
Yeah, I think so too. There are so many things around us, you know, that we, if we could just open our eyes to get creative about, you know, how to plug up the waste streams and reuse things. And there's a beautiful project in our town called the Bike Project that that teaches kids how to work on bikes and fix, you know, all of the thrown away bikes. And, you know, just things like that are so amazing. I often see, as many of us do, the all the fruit that just falls out of our trees at the end of the summer and goes to waste. And I think about all the creative things that could be done with that, and you know, the food that it could provide for so many. And, you know, there are these things all around us all the time.
You know, it's funny you mention that because, you know, I was trying to take food, and particularly fruits and produce in California, that is wasted, but also elders. And our kind of our unofficial motto was, you know, wrinkle food, wrinkle people, no waste, you know, no waste.
Yeah.
You know, if people instinctively understand how wrong it is to throw away food because it has a bruise or a blemish, you know, part of what I was trying to do was say to people, look, isn't it just as wrong to waste an individual because they might have the bruise of incarceration or the blemish, wrinkle of age? You know, see past that, just as we can see that we, if we just cut the small little bruise off the tomato, how much beautiful, nutritious food is left, realize that those people that we look at have just as much promise.
Yeah. You were telling me about a gathering or a festival in the little town that you are in now in northern New Mexico. And I wonder if you could, you know, kind of share again your insights from bringing people together like that around food.
Well, you know, again, I live in a little town now of 300 people where my wife and sister-in-law, and we live together kind of as a family unit, where they grew up. And I was at a fiesta recently, and it's funny, Gwen, looking back, I mentioned earlier that the meals and the program that I started have produced, you know, tens of millions of meals, but they were primarily distributed via pantries and food banks and those kind of places where you almost have to self-identify as poor to get a meal. And here I was at this little volunteer firehouse watching all the people of this small town, you know, older people, young, you know, addicts, you know, rough around the edge bikers, you know, everybody was eating together and talking. And as I looked out in the room, I thought, wow, what an interesting idea. You know, the idea of community meals, you know, could we set up? And instead, again, of trying to say, kids, you go over there and eat, seniors, you eat over there, poor, and we'll give you a box of food. What would it be like if we tried to fight hunger with community or fight it with tradition? And I think out here in the West, you have this fiesta culture in which communities come together. And of course, all around the world, you look at luau's or the wedding feast, this idea of community meals. So I'm really focused on that right now. What's it like? What would it be for just small towns on a regular basis? In fact, next weekend, I'm going out to a little town, maybe two little counties over, and they do a big community breakfast every Saturday. So it's not a new idea, but it's one that I want to explore at this phase of my life.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that's being talked about lately is the need for tighter social bonds in our communities as we become more under stress, you know, from many things happening in the world. And that seems like a strategy that that will be very, very helpful.
It's more than just eating next to each other, which has a huge benefit. But you can also start to add in things like, you know, imagine how many people in a community might say, if an elder said, you know, I just need somebody to drive me to the grocery store once a week. Somebody might say, you know, hey, I can do that. And that kind of almost change of and people who want to help and people who need it but don't know where to go,
yeah,
it just opens so many doors. So,
yeah,
again, that's my new thing, you know.
I love it.
you know, be charity.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Robert. Always such a pleasure to get to talk with you. And thank you all in the listening audience for being with us today. If you have a question or a thought for Robert or me, please join the Facebook page at The Inner Game. The page acts as a forum to continue these conversations, and you can find out where to listen to past shows there as well. Until next time, as Robert likes to say, keep your soul buff.
Right on, sister. Thanks again.